Welcome to Nature Calls, conversations from the Hudson Valley. Our team's goal is to present science-based information about gardening and all things nature in New York's Hudson Valley. Host Gene and Tim, along with team members Teresa and Linda, are master gardener volunteers for New York's Columbia and Greene counties. So if you're interested in gardening or nature or nuggets of information about what's happening outside your door, settle in. Enjoy the conversation. Whatever the season, we have something to say.
Hi, I'm Tim Kennelty.
And I'm Gene Thomas.
And welcome to Nature Calls, conversations from the Hudson Valley. Got a great show today, don't we, Gene?
Start out with food. That always amuses me.
Food is a good place to start.
Yeah, Annie talks on Patch to Plate about roasting peppers and tomatoes and doing other things with Tunisian tomato and pepper stew.
You know, roasting always makes everything taste better.
Oh, it does indeed.
Yummy.
And then you do some stuff with your good plant, bad plant.
Yeah, good plant, bad plant. Yeah.
What's the good one?
The good one is a really good one. It's asters, and asters are great pollinator plants. They're also great host plants, so it's really good. And the bad one's a really bad one.
Tree of heaven?
Ailanthus.
Why do they call it that?
That's it should be wrong. Tree of you know what else.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's also really invasive, but it's also the host for spotted lanternfly, those evil insects. And
different stuff, different stages, right?
Exactly.
Then Annie talks to us about the Grateful Shed.
It's a new feature, right? It's a new feature. She's going to talk about all kinds of garden tools. I love that.
And she starts out with forks.
Why not start with forks? A good garden fork is really hard to come by.
And where did you find out how many kinds there are?
There are many garden forks, but you want a garden fork.
Yes, you need at least one. I have several.
It's a lot of things to talk about, from tomatoes to garden forks to spotted lanternflies.
Pretty good. It's going to be fun.
Hi, I'm Annie Skubinski. I'm a Master Gardener volunteer and a member of the Nature Calls podcast team. In today's Patch to Plate episode, I'm going to talk about eating peppers and tomatoes. If you haven't heard Teresa Golden's talk about growing tomatoes, you can get up to speed with a link in our show notes to that segment. You'll also probably want to listen to Jean's and Tim's wonderful interview with Miriam Rubin. She's the author of a book titled Tomatoes. Peppers and tomatoes, onions, garlic, parsley too, everything in the garden is ready. The farm stands are brimming. Even if we don't need much, every week we tour the farms. We visit our local farm stands, our favorites, and we see what's fresh and available, sometimes what's new or different. We pick up those items that we don't grow ourselves but recognize as seasonal, fresh, and we want to incorporate into this week's meals. We typically have bell peppers, serranos, jalapenos, fresnos, maybe shishitos, and Thai hots growing too in our garden. For us, more peppers, more better. Both peppers and tomatoes pair well together, and they share an affinity for cheese, particularly goat cheese, gorgonzola, and parmesan. Both peppers and tomatoes love garlic, olive oil, onions, thyme, and the acid of vinegar. Keep those common compatibilities in mind when you're putting together your recipe or choosing among recipes. If another veggie, a particular herb, a dash of vinegar, or a sprinkle of a certain cheese will bring out the best attributes of more than one key ingredient, you're really increasing your chances of creating a tasty dish. Let's talk about a simple dish, fast food, dinner in under 30 minutes. Start by placing the oven rack about 6 inches below the broiler and preheat the oven to a hot 425 degrees Fahrenheit. Gather your ingredients. You'll need one sausage link per person, about 3 or 4 ounces of cherry or grape tomatoes, a half an onion, and the equivalent of one bell pepper. You may want to mix up the peppers. We like red, yellow, and orange all together in this dish. And those proportions are just the suggestion based on the way that we prepare this meal. You're the one who knows your audience, and so add a little more of that, omit something else, or pull back on the amount so that it really fits in the way your folks like to eat. What you're going to do is grab a sheet pan and put 3 or 4 ounces of the cherry tomatoes per person on that. Wedge up an onion into 4 or 6 wedges, depending on how big it is. Cut your pepper into strips 2 inches wide. Slice up some garlic and grab the dried thyme. What you want to do is either spray or toss the veggies with olive oil, sprinkle everything with thyme, and give it all a good squeeze of lemon. Sprinkle it sparingly with salt. Now, if you're using a raw sausage like Italian, sweet, or spicy sausage, you'll want to score the links of sausage or cut them into long diagonal coins and put them on the sheet pan with the veggies and get some olive oil on that as well. If you're using pre-cooked sausage, like a chicken and spinach sausage or vegetarian or vegan sausage, you can slice them up, but hold off putting them in the oven yet. You don't want them to dry out. So now you put your sheet pan in the oven, either with or without the sausage, and set the timer for about 5 minutes. After 5 minutes, you'll want to pull it out, toss the veggies, toss the sausage if it's in there. If not, add the sausage at this point and add the garlic too. Pop it back in the oven for another 10 minutes or so. The sausage should be cooked or warmed through and the garlic just beginning to color. The tomatoes will have collapsed. If you'd like a little bit more browning on the meal, change the oven setting to broil and give it a final 3, 4, or 5 minutes. Now pull it out. Sprinkle with freshly grated Parmesan or Gorgonzola, and either give it another squeeze of lemon or offer lemon wedges with it when you serve it. For serving suggestions, you can have this over rice, tossed with pasta, or on a piece of toasted sourdough. Mmm, summer. If you don't want to heat your oven, you can do this same preparation in a large skillet. When we cook it on the stovetop, we call it hearty root sauce in honor of all the goodies we've received in our CSA share from our CSA hearty roots. Don't want sausage tonight? Set the oven at 405 degrees Fahrenheit. Peel and clean some shrimp. Add them to the veggies. Spray and bake for 15 minutes, approximately, until the shrimp are curled and pink. This meal is great on toast, and you can toast your bread at the same time you're cooking the shrimp and veggies in the hot oven. If you prefer a vegan option tonight for dinner, cooked white beans, cannellini beans, would be my choice. Again, 15 minutes at the higher temp would be good. Now I want to offer an outstanding pepper standalone. This takes a bit of time, but the dish is largely unattended for most of it. For two, I like a red bell pepper for its sweetness in this dish. Preheat the oven to 350 Fahrenheit, cut a pepper in half from stem to base, scrape out the ribs and seeds. A teaspoon's a handy tool for that. Sliver a clove of garlic. Put the peppers cut side up in an oiled roasting pan. Divide the slivers of garlic into the peppers, season with salt and pepper, and spray with olive oil or dribble olive oil lightly onto the garlic. Roast that for 40 minutes. 10 minutes before the 40's up, heat a frying pan, spray with oil, and pan sear some scallops or saute some shelled and clean shrimp. Remove the peppers from the oven, dollop with pesto, and top with the seafood. White beans like giant lima beans would be a great vegetarian substitute for that meal. For a standalone tomato, preheat the broiler with the rack 6 inches from the heat source. Cut a ripe but still firm tomato in half across the equator. Rub it or spray it with olive oil. Sprinkle with Parmesan or some other melty cheese of choice. Dust with herbs and broil it. It'll be a quick 3 to 5 minutes until the cheese is melted and browning. Drizzle with balsamic vinegar. This is a favorite summer side in our house. I haven't included any recipes for the dishes I've described. They're simple preparations with lots of flexibility. In the show notes, I did include a recipe for another favorite, Tunisian tomato and pepper stew. Our Master Gardener's Cookbook has a garden salsa recipe highlighting peppers and tomatoes, and that can be served as an appetizer with chips or as an accompaniment for chicken or fish. Call the office if you'd like a copy of the cookbook. For other recipes, please go to the nutrition page on our Cornell website. Enjoy. That's it for this edition of From Patch to Plate. I'm Annie Skibinski.
You're listening to Nature Calls, conversations from the Hudson Valley. Stay tuned for Good Plant, Bad Plant.
Welcome to Good Plant, Bad Plant, where we focus on two plants per episode, one that's ecologically valuable and one that's at the other end of the spectrum. That is, it's invasive or a noxious weed. Thus, good plant, bad plant. I'm your host, Tim Kennelty. In this episode, we're going to talk about two A plants, one good plant and one bad. The good plant is the beautiful and beneficial late-blooming aster, and the bad one is one that some people think is beautiful, but it's really a nasty character, Tree of Heaven. Or if we're talking Latin, its A name is Ailanthus altissima. So let's start with the good plant, the genus Aster. I must confess that what we think of as our native asters, like the commonly called New England or New York fall-blooming asters, are no longer in the botanical world referred to as, well, asters. You may not know this, but every 5 years, the International Botanical Congress meets to update naming nomenclature for plants. Well, a few years ago, they decided that Eurasian and American asters were different enough to be classified with different genuses. Thus, the roughly 180 American or New World asters were forced to find new names under different genera. I tell you this only because if you go to the nursery looking for asters, you're most likely going to be looking under the Latin name Symphotrichum. Don't despair, most nurseries still refer to these beautiful plants as asters, and for simplicity's sake, so am I. Okay, enough about naming. Why am I talking about asters? Because they are such great garden plants. If you want vibrant color in shades of purple and pink and even white, and you want to support pollinators, you really should think about adding asters to your garden. Both New England and New York asters are native to the Northeast and thrive in a wide range of growing conditions. In general, they prefer full sun and well-drained soil and are relatively easy to grow. New England asters have full, plump blooms and woody stems, while New York asters have smooth leaves and thinner stems. There are many, many cultivars and subcategories of asters ranging in height from 1 to 6 feet. Most, however, are perennial, have daisy-like colorful flowers, and bloom anytime between August and October. I've even had asters in my Hudson Valley garden blooming at Thanksgiving. Asters can be nibbled on by rabbits and deer, so you should really keep that in mind when placing them in the garden. Some of my favorite cultivars are Purple Cloud, Kickin' Carmen Red, and Elma Pachki. But there are countless others, and I think it's safe to say there's a cultivar for every taste. Besides being beautiful, asters attract and support many late-season pollinators in the garden. And in the winter, don't cut them back as they provide food and shelter for many bird species and small mammals. They are even a host plant for painted lady and pearl crescent butterflies. In fact, Doug Tallamy includes asters on his Keystone Species list, which is a group of plants that are the most important for supporting wildlife. So if you need some beautiful late season color and you want to be kind to the birds and bees, plant some asters in your garden. Now for the really bad actor, the inappropriately named Tree of Heaven, or Ailanthus altissima. And of course, when I say bad actor, it's not the plant's fault that it's an invasive pest in our area. For any invasive non-native plant, some human brought it to our shores thinking it was beautiful, a food source, or had medicinal value. Tree of Heaven, which is native to China, was first introduced in Philadelphia in the late 1700s. Thereafter, it was widely planted in urban areas from New York City to Washington, D.C. At the time, it was thought to be an attractive ornamental tree that was fast-growing and tolerated a wide range of conditions. By the early 1900s, attitudes toward this plant began to change because of its weedy nature and foul odor. Today, it's thought to be highly invasive. More about that in a minute. Tree of Heaven is a fast-growing deciduous tree that can reach heights of 80 to 100 feet. Its leaves have a central stem with multiple lance-shaped leaflets on either side. When crushed, the leaves have a strong, offensive odor. The tree's leaves closely resemble those of two natives, black walnut and sumac. I have all three on my property, and it can be really confusing. The main difference is that both black walnut and sumac leaves are serrated, while Tree of Heaven leaves have margins that are smooth. Like many invasive plants, Tree of Heaven has multiple reproductive strategies. Female trees can produce more than 300,000 seeds that are wind dispersed. Individual trees spread through aggressive root suckering. A new sprout can emerge as much as 50 feet away from the tree. In addition, leaves, roots, and bark of the tree contain allelopathic chemicals which inhibit establishment of native plants. So as you can imagine, this plant can be highly destructive to native ecosystems, pushing out valuable plants and often forming monocultures. This plant has one more bad trait. It is the primary host of the spotted lanternfly. This is a highly destructive invasive insect, which is on the verge of establishing itself in our area. So if you identify Tree of Heaven in your yard, what should you do? If you have small shoots, you can pull them when the soil is damp, but make sure you remove all of the underground shoot or the plant will resprout. For larger stands, cutting or mowing is usually ineffective because the plant will quickly reproduce a large number of resprouts. For effective control, you'll probably need to use herbicides. As always, use caution and read all the labels and follow the instructions. I'm including links about this plant with more information on identification and control. So that's it for another edition of Good Plant, Bad Plant. And as always, if you want to support wildlife in your yard, plant those natives.
You're listening to Nature Calls, conversations from the Hudson Valley.
Welcome to the Grateful Shed, a new Nature Calls segment focused on garden tools. I'm Annie Skibinski. Before we focus on specific garden tools, I want to share a couple of thoughts on the wood used for tool handles. You'll want to choose your garden tools for long-lasting performance, so if the handle and shaft are made from wood, it should be hardwood. The handles of good garden tools are typically fashioned from ash, and the reason to choose ash is that it has a fine grain and a natural shock-absorbing quality that makes it shatter-resistant to the forces of normal garden duties. Only American hickory is stronger, and you'll see that used for handles on some digging tools, as well as heavy impact tools like axes, hammers, mallets, sledges, and hatchets. So when we suggest an ash or hickory handle, that's the background thinking. Usually I talk about cooking with garden vegetables, so I'm going to start this new segment by talking about forks. The garden fork is also called a spading fork or a digging fork. It has a handle and a square-shouldered head with typically four short, tapered, and sturdy tines. The garden fork is the all-around number one fork for the Grateful Shed. It's used for loosening, lifting, and turning over soil. It's effective in digging into hard-packed earth, since all of the pressure driven through the tool is focused on the four thin, chisel-pointed tines. You'll want a garden fork if you need to break up hard, packed soil. You place the tines against the soil and with one foot press or stand on the shoulder of the fork to drive it down as far into the ground as possible. Then you pull back on the handle toward you to pry out the soil. This breaks or loosens the soil. You repeat these steps until the soil is loose and crumbly. An Another way to use a garden fork is to mix compost or other organic matter into your soil, making sure that it's evenly distributed. This will help improve soil fertility and provide natural nutrients for your plants. You'll be happy to have the tool on hand when you're harvesting root vegetables. Quick side note, I've put a link to the show notes to Teresa's Veggie Patch episode on root vegetables. You can hear about growing root vegetables there. In addition to using the tool as a cultivator and harvester, you'll use it to aerate your garden soil. To use it for aerating soil, insert the tines into the soil and gently rock the fork back and forth to create holes. Repeat this process every few inches until the entire area has been aerated. Be careful, though, not to damage any plant roots while you're doing this aerating motion. Putting your garden fork to use in this way increases nutrient and water absorption and encourages earthworm activity, all of which improve your soil structure, which of course gives the roots of your plants a better chance to thrive. You'll use the fork, too, for turning your compost pile and for mixing in other materials. Choose a garden fork made of forged steel that comes halfway up the length of the fork and is riveted to an ash or hickory handle. A tool like this won't bend under heavy use. That makes it a long-lasting investment. On to other forks you may want in your grateful shed. A pitchfork or hay fork is used to pitch loose material such as hay, straw, manure, or leaves. It has a long handle and usually 2 to 5 thin tines designed to effectively move agricultural materials. The pitchfork has a couple of slight advantages over the garden fork. It'll be up to you to decide if your adventures warrant another tool. A standard 4-tined pitchfork is the best choice for breaking up and turning compost. The 4 curved tines make it easy to lightly pull apart clumps of compost without disturbing the soil beneath. This type of pitchfork is also great for aerating the soil around plants in a raised bed or garden since it can reach deeper into the soil than a garden fork. Use a broad fork, which is a shallow cultivation tool, to prepare your garden beds. When you cultivate shallowly, no deeper than 2 inches, you can kill off weed sprouts without bringing up weed seeds, which may be buried more deeply in the soil. Sometimes a broad fork is called a U-fork. It has 2 long vertical handles, one at each end of a crossbar that sports 5 or 6 tines. To use the tool, you hold each handle in one hand, place the tines where you want to start cultivating, use your foot on the crossbar to press the tines into the soil, and then pull back on the handles. This lifts the soil without turning it over. It's a good tool for shallow cultivation. A hand fork, as the name suggests, is great for breaking up soil and cultivating in smaller areas. There are, of course, many, many, many more forks in grateful sheds across our region. You may hear of digging forks, bedding forks, manure forks, and drags. I'll include a link to a comprehensive book on tools in the show notes. Look for Smith & Hawken, The Tool Book for the Well-Tended Garden by William Bryant Logan. A copy is available in my library. I'm a member of the Mid-Hudson Library System. That's it for this episode of The Grateful Shed. I'm Annie Skibinski.
That concludes another episode of Nature Calls, Conversations from the Hudson Valley. We would like to thank Sandra Linnell and Devin Connolly from Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties for production support. And a special thank you to our listeners for joining us on this episode of Nature Calls, Conversations from the Hudson Valley. You can find links to any of the topics mentioned in this episode at our website at ccecolumbiagreen.org. Comments and suggestions for future topics may be directed to us at columbiagreenmgb@cornell.edu or on the CCE Master Gardener Volunteers of Columbia and Greene Counties Facebook page. For more information about Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties, visit our website at ccecolumbiagreen.org or visit us in Hudson or in Acre. Cornell Cooperative Extension provides equal programming and employment opportunities.